last night. Last night we talked about the intellect, logic, limits, how far it can go, how far it can't go. Today I want to apply the idea to a particular realm, a realm in which it's not often discussed, a realm in which it's a little sort of mixing apples and oranges a little bit today, and see if we can't get, you know, food salad, something nice out of it. When we think of logic, I think we associate with logic and intellect questions of true and false, fact, science, getting right or wrong answers to puzzles. I don't think that we usually associate with logic emotions, feelings. I think for many people, emotions belong to another world. You know, if you feel a certain way, that's the way you feel. It can seem to be just a non-question: is my feeling right or wrong, true or false, correct or incorrect? That's the way I feel. I like certain things, I don't like other things. Certain things make me happy, certain things make me unhappy. Certain things make me calm, certain things excite me. The whole question of logic, as applied to feelings, seems to be totally out of place. We know that in logic you can get something right or you can get it wrong. You can make mistakes, correct, you can have better logic, worse logic. Feelings just seem to be what happens to you. That's just the way it is. It'd be like saying, the color of the table is illogical. That's ridiculous. It just is what it is. It's not logical, it's not illogical. That's the color that the table is. You say, well, I like Bach. That's really crazy, right? That's definitely illogical. I like flowers. I like sunsets. I don't like antique china. Is that logical or illogical? Right or wrong? I like chess games. Chess games really excite me. Whereas football is boring. People banging into each other and banging into each other and bang, not to mention baseball, in which 3/4 of the time nothing happens. Right? And cricket's even worse because it's the same thing happening over and over and over again. It's utterly predictable, you know. 350 rounds in one game, runs in one game. Ridiculous. So feelings are just, that's the way you are. You have these feelings. So the idea of criticizing feelings, analyzing feelings, and judging certain feelings more logical or less logical, more true, less true, more valid, less valid, seems to be a very strange idea. At the outset, intuitively, it seems to be a very strange idea. Seems that if someone would say this feeling is an illogical feeling, he'd be mixing apples and oranges. It wouldn't have anything to do with one of them. Now, this is clearly a mistake. What I'm telling you, if it feels comfortable, what I'm telling you now seems so obvious, I'm just warning you, I'm raising the red light. Right? This is a total mistake. Yeah.
But if two feelings contradict each other.
Oh, okay. Let's start with that. That's interesting. I didn't think of that. Let's start with that. two feelings contradict one another. What would that mean?
You like something, you love something else.
So let's hear how it was the end.
I have two feelings, and by doing what does it mean to do a feeling? A feeling is just what I am, right? That's how I feel. Oh, so now, how would the feeling be connected to action? So I feel this. What's it got to do with doing anything?
What is feeling? Your feeling, usually you do something because of the feeling. You like listening to music, so you listen to the music.
Okay, but then it's a decision that I'm making on the basis of the feeling. So now maybe what you mean is, let's say I like A and I like B, and in my world I can't do both, so I have to decide whether to do A or whether to do B, and deciding to do A contradicts deciding to do B. That I can understand. Contradictions, decisions could contradict one another, but the feelings don't contradict one another. The feelings are just there. It's what you're deciding to do on the basis of the feelings that might give you a contradiction.
He didn't love him.
What's that he's saying? That's not what he's saying, right? You're saying something else. Okay, one thing at a time. So I don't see yet in what you're saying a contradiction between feelings. Now he suggests, what about, oh, it was you. Okay, my peripheral vision didn't get over there. He says, what about loving and hating the same person? Now, how will we describe the contradiction here? Why, let's just say, I love him and I hate him. That's right. Yeah, I have two feelings. Why would you call them contradictory?
Because one describes one aspect and one completely goes against it.
What does it mean, go against? Go against sounds like just more English for contradict. You know, I want to know what
the... one that's stronger than they're good to go.
Say that again?
As long as one is stronger, then they're good. Which means if you love a guy, then you have the hater. It's really, if you love something, then you have to hate. It's really, if the love is bigger than the hate, then really love it, if you have the hating point.
Okay, but he made a suggestion, and I don't see how these comments are helping his suggestion. I'm asking for a case where feelings could contradict one another. He suggests, I love and hate the same person. That would be contradictory feelings. Now I'm asking, what makes them contradictory more than just, I have two feelings towards the same person? Why do you call them contradictory? What about them makes them into a contradiction? Maybe my question isn't clear. When you say that a person has contradictory beliefs, what he says contradicts himself, what you mean is, since he has a contradiction, not everything he believes can be true. Because if A contradicts B, they can't both be true. That's where it's contradictory. That's where it hurts. It hurts because you lost something. Namely, you lost some truth. You're definitely making a mistake someplace. Now, I ask, I have these two feelings for Joe. I hate Joe and I love Joe. Okay? Now you say, not only do you have these two feelings, I want you to know they contradict one another. So I want to know, where is the contradiction? There's just two feelings that I have, and I just have them. That's all. What is opposite in what respect? What does opposite mean here?
They're characteristics.
Oh, maybe some very subtle people here. He says the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is having no feeling. But then what will be the opposite of hate?
No feeling. Either way, it puts
you. So could love and hate both have the same opposite?
No.
That sounds a little odd, no? Two so different, seemingly opposed things should have the same opposite?
If you don't care, you don't find yourself in a relationship with that person. If you hate, you're in a relationship. Or right. If you love, you're in a relationship. More than that, I don't
know. Okay, but then the question would be, what should I call opposite here? Let me suggest this, something which would support what he said and see if you like it. Suppose someone said, I'll tell you why love and hate contradict one another. They contradict one another because the more you love him, the less you're going to hate him. The more you hate him, the less you're going to love him. Emotionally, they're in conflict because you can't support the two of them simultaneously. You know, the more you have one, the less you're going to have the other. One drives the other out. That's the contradiction. One drives the other out.
I thought you had more than one.
Is that true? I don't know if it's true. I don't know if it's true, or maybe it's true in some limited sense. Imagine someone who has mild love and mild hate for the same person. Couldn't we imagine that person doing some very nice and some very nasty things, which ups both of them, increases the love and decreases the hate? I would imagine you could. So it simply isn't true that as the love goes up, the hate goes down, and as the hate goes up, the love goes down. So where's the contradiction? Well, what do they contradict one another? They're just two very strong feelings about the same person. Why do you want to call them contradictory?
You're a walking contradiction. You're doing something to the same person that elevates your love for the person, and you're elevates now we're getting back to the whole decision and acting on it.
Okay, then you're back to him. In other words, the feelings are not contradictory. What I would do out of love and what I would do out of hate contradict one another.
No, but
that could be, but then you understand you're sort of making the contradiction secondary. It's not in the feeling itself.
The difference between the actions and the difference between the feelings.
Okay, so if we go this route, we're not really saying that feelings contradict one another.
I don't want to
they're really contradict one another. Just when I come to act on them, they'll lead me to do opposite things.
Okay.
That could be, but then I'm not getting really a sense of contradiction in the feelings themselves, which may be all right, this may be realistic. That may be the way feelings are.
We're attributing all our feelings to, we're putting it all into the other person right now, in acting upon and doing and raising up and raising. Forget that for a minute. I love so-and-so and I hate so-and-so. He's the other side of the world.
Right.
I'm sitting here now, inside of me there's a contradiction boiling.
Why do you call it a contradiction rather than just two very strong feelings you have about that person on the other side of the world? What does the word contradiction do for you that you couldn't do without it? Why? I explained to you. In beliefs, the word contradiction means not everything is true. So there's a definite loss here. Over here, when you call it contradictory, what more do you say then? I have two very strong feelings.
The fact that two very strong feelings don't agree with each other inside your
what mind. Does don't agree mean? Don't agree in what respect? Is the love telling the hate to stop? You're a mistake. Why? If the person has done very good things and very bad things. The very good things lead me to love him. The very bad things lead me to hate him. All are true. All are real. Why would one feeling tell the other feeling to go away?
It's not perfect, but you compromise because of the love. If you can't compromise and both feelings are in your head,
yes,
then obviously one of them is not greater than the other.
Right.
One is not stronger than the other.
Okay.
If they're two equally strong things, that makes no sense. First,
why does it make no sense?
Because it doesn't let you sit settled. If a person can't sit settled, then there's something wrong.
Oh.
It's not a contradiction, I can't turn.
Let's see. So now the definition will be, if it unsettles me, if it doesn't allow me to be tranquil, then I'm going to call it a contradiction. But couldn't that be true with a single emotion also? Without doubles. Someone is in love with someone and the other person just really doesn't care. I think that person will be unsettled and tense and worried and upset and try to do something about it, and he only has one emotion. So the fact that I'm unsettled is not a symptom of something special about two emotions contradicting one another.
But
it's just a case of...
But one emotion, there is a method of action that you would take. There is only one, let's call it forgetting the other person again, train of thought.
Oh, so now we're back to action. Bakasha. Okay, so then we said, if you're going to pin it on action, that's all right.
So
what you're saying then is, the two emotions contradict one another because when I ask myself, what should I do about one, I get this plan of action. When I ask myself, what should I do about the other, I get a different contradictory plan of action. That's understandable. That's understandable. Only the contradiction now has been placed externally to the action, to the emotion.
I guess that's what it all comes down to.
It could be. Could be. I mean, a famous philosopher said there's no logic to emotions whatsoever. So I'm sort of running through some of his arguments and, you know, and actually doing quite well. Yeah.
It seems to me that there could be a logic in the explanation of an emotion. Or if you can find a reason for the emotion, then you could find a reason for an emotion. Like, you can hate someone because they punched you in the face for no reason. So then it sounds logical in a way that you hate them and you have an emotion to them. So I'm saying that there could be logic to emotion. Now, why can't you say that?
Okay, I'm coming to that. This is where I want to get. So what he said now is where I want to get. That's where I want to get. I want to just put one intermediary step, and then I want to get there, because that's really what I'm interested in today. Yeah?
In the case of not being loved back by the other person, it's not just one emotion. The love is not the one that's, the emotion that's making you feel you want to do something about it. It's some other feeling, like dissatisfaction or something. The love is not making you feel...
That's not clear. Okay, I don't want to debate that now, but that's not really clear. Here's an example that a philosopher gave a couple of years ago, opening up a whole area which is currently under exploration, an area which was really very enlightening to me. Suppose a person says, I'm really worried. I'm worried because X might happen. I'm distraught about it, and I'm concerned about it. I keep reading the papers to make it, to find out, will it happen, won't it happen? You know, like maybe, God forbid, Labor can win the election. That would really be worrying, you know, nerve-wracking, anxiety-producing, and so on and so on. Right, so this is what he tells me. I'm really worried and upset and nervous that X might happen. Next day you see him, and you say, he looks, his face is beaming, and he's happy, and he's relaxed. What happened? He said, oh, thank God, X happened. Now I'm happy. I think something went desperately wrong there, right? Yesterday he was worried, anxious, fearful that X might happen. Now X happened, and he's happy, tranquil, content, and satisfied. Something's gone wrong there. Right? Something abnormal. Without some further explanation, something has gone wrong. There is a kind of logic of the emotions, the way they connect with one another. If you are in worry and dread that X might happen, and X happens, you ought to be devastated and unhappy afterwards. Not happy and tranquil afterwards. That shouldn't be the outcome. So there are connections between emotions, especially connections over time, and if the connections don't work out right, something illogical has happened. There's something seriously wrong with such a person. I don't think you would want to hire him for an employee, because you could never tell what he was going to do next. Because his emotions are unhitched with one another. They're not hitched up in the normal structure. At any rate, but now let's go to his example. His example is what I'm really looking for. Let's take fear. I don't know if anybody here fits this description, but I tell you there are adults. Who? Adults. Yes, okay, you're adults. I agree. Sort of. It's nighttime, and you're sitting at home, and you're very comfortable and content, and then there's a power out, and all the lights go out. All the lights in the whole area. There's some people who feel fear. They just feel afraid. Their pulse rate goes up, and they start breathing heavy, and they start to sweat. Now, they tell themselves, listen, there are no gremlins under the bed. You know, I gave that up when I was six. And there are no marauders in my neighborhood who are going to come battering down the doors under the cover of night when the police can't see you and so on and so on. I'm really not in any danger. Yep, they tell themselves that. But they're frightened out of their wits. Couldn't we say here that this is an irrational emotion? What's irrational about it? Because certain emotions are designed to help me respond to the world around me. You've probably heard about the flee or fight response. The fight or flee response is designed to help you deal with danger. So your adrenaline kind of starts running up, you know, and you change your posture and your muscles tense. Because either you're going to have to fight the other person or you're going to have to run away from the other person. But now let's suppose you're not in danger. You mistake the local sign for a friendly greeting for preparation to punch you in the nose. And you're just mistaken because, you know, in southern Italy, that's the way they say hello. And you think he's going to attack you. Isn't your fear illogical, out of place, inappropriate, invalid, wrong, inadvisable? Mistaken, all those nasty words. Because emotions often are designed to respond to certain realities in the world around you. And if you have the emotion when the world isn't that way, then the emotion really is a mistake. To go back to the example that I either give or allude to over and over again, when someone has an infatuation for another person, and you, looking from the outside, know that the other person is using him as dirt, doesn't care for him at all, and he's lost. He's just lost. He's got stars in his eyes, and he can't see it. He can't see it. He can't understand it. And you say to him, you fool. She doesn't care a fig for you. She's going to dump you when it serves her purpose. And you're trailing around and he can't even hear you. And you pity him. Why do you pity him? He has his feelings. You have your feelings. What's the pity for? The pity for is because his feelings are out of touch with the reality. His feelings are appropriate for an entirely different reality, and he can't see what's right under his nose. See, here's where you could criticize a feeling. If the feeling is supposed to help you relate to a reality in a certain way, and the reality isn't there, and the guy has the feeling, or the other way around, lacks the feeling, he's in danger and just is unconcerned. And he's going to get hurt, or could very well get hurt, and because he doesn't feel the danger, he doesn't take the appropriate steps. So you say this person is dangerously out of touch. His feelings do not correspond to the real world in which he's living. And that's just too bad. I know that when I competed, when I used to wrestle, the coach said, when you go out there on the mat and the bell rings, you have to have one thought in your mind. I'm going to kill him. If you don't have that feeling, he said, you're not going to win. I don't care how strong your muscles are, I don't know how fast you can do a takedown. If you don't have that feeling, you're not going to win. Because that's the feeling that enables you to win in competitive sports. If you don't have that feeling, you're out of touch with the competitive situation. Sure, afterwards you shake his hand, especially if he loses. That's no problem. But while you're out there, there's only one feeling. Murder. I'm going to murder him. So, feelings then can be in touch or out of touch with the world around you. And when they're out of touch, they are, in that sense, illogical. Yeah.
So, are you saying that people can conceivably be, some people can be like walking, just walking disasters because they don't know they don't know what they should do in that instance, and then they're automatically defaulting again because they don't know. So either action they might choose is self-destructive.
It could very well be, and this is especially the case if your feelings are out of touch or if you don't appreciate the feelings of others. If you don't appreciate the feelings of others, then your actions are often going to be self-destructive and you won't even know it. Yeah.
So what should you do? What should the normal person do off of it? Because if so, you're like, well, I'm not prepared for the situation, then your alternative is so what?
I think over here, this business is so subtle and it's so pervasive. The only thing that I know of practical to do is to talk to other people. Talk to people about things happen, especially when things happen unexpectedly. Gosh, I did this and I got that reaction. Why did that happen? I didn't think he'd react like that. As it means you're out of touch. Your feelings are out of touch with his feelings, and you didn't appreciate where he was and where you were. And then and that's why these things happen. Yeah.
Your feelings are out of touch with his feelings, or maybe one person's feelings are out of touch with the norm.
Both. It could be both of those. It could be combinations.
And
now,
their emotions could be stimulated or prevented.
I think that's also right. Although that's a long story. Now, the reason I tell you this is because I want to share with you a Jewish idea which, from this point of view, is a bit surprising. From what I've told you, it seems, personality and emotion, you should ask yourself, what reality is this emotion designed to relate to? And then check, is the real world that way or is it not? And if it isn't, then you got a problem and you ought to change things. The surprising thing is that Jewishly we don't work that way. Jewishly we do allow, reinforce, even stamp as appropriate emotions which are in a certain sense out of touch with reality. The question will be why? And I'll give you some insight into that. The ultimate question is, if we're supposed to tolerate or even reinforce emotions that are out of touch with reality in this way, how then can you tell what emotions are right and what emotions are wrong? That's a much more difficult question.
Well, why shouldn't you be told to
connect to reality? Okay, so I'll let me give you some examples, and I'll show you what it means, and then we'll ask that question. In Tehillim, David HaMelech says, Hashem Lama sisham. Hashem, why are you sleeping? Pekach einecho ra'ei. Open your eyes and see. Now, this is King David talking. And King David is saying, Hashem, why are you sleeping? Open your eyes and see. King David here is talking when he's in trouble, in pain, perhaps being chased by King Saul, who was trying to kill him. David was hiding in caves and getting support from the non-Jewish kings in the area with whom he was friendly, and he's pretty desperate. Now, King David had no illusions about God. God is sometimes sleeping, that's for sure. God sometimes has his eyes closed, doesn't know what's going on. King David had no difficulty with his theology, knowing what God's powers are. Still, he said these words, and by saying these words, he was expressing his emotions. Emotions of fear, emotions of being abandoned, emotions of being in terrible danger. And he used words which are clearly out of touch with reality. Which means that his emotions are out of touch with reality. That's how he felt. An illustration of this, even closer to our times, and much more dramatic in a certain way, of Lady Yitzchak of Berdichev, one of the great Hasidic masters, at a time of great pogroms, persecution, called together a bez din, a court, to hear a case. And the case was the Jewish people versus God. And the complaint was that God is not protecting the Jewish people from suffering, from punishment, from persecution. And they had a lot of evidence, and they reviewed all the evidence, and then the judges discussed the evidence, and in the end they took a vote, and the decision of the court was guilty. God is guilty. And then, together with the assembled people, they got up and said Kaddish. Kaddish, which means we glorify and magnify and exalt and sanctify God's name and so forth and so on. But what Rebbe Lady Yitzchak Berdichev was doing was to give a review to the facts as we see them and to evaluate them and to go on record that from our point of view, from what we can see, from what we can understand, from what we feel, guilty. Because we know it can't be true. Can't be true. We must be making mistakes somewhere. We're only seeing part of the picture. But that Beis Din, together with the psak, with the decision of the Beis Din, gives very vivid expression to the feeling of pain and the feeling that we're getting a raw deal. The feeling. Even though we know intellectually that it's not true. Another example. The Mishnah Bracha says, just as you make a blessing on good things that happen, you also make a blessing on bad things that happen. But it's not the same blessing. On good things that happen, you say God is hatov ha-meitiv, is good and does good. On bad things that happen, you say God is a dayan ha-me'emes, a true judge, or a judge of truth. Now the Talmud asks, what happens if something both good and bad happens? A single thing that's both good and bad. For example, here's the Gemara's example. You're a farmer, and your farm, your field, ends at the level, at the edge of a river. And you have a wheat crop standing in your field 2 days from harvest. Day after tomorrow, you're going to cut it down and harvest it. Now you understand, a wheat crop takes 8 months. 6 months, wherever you are, from plowing and planting and watering and growing. That day, 48 hours before the harvest, the river overflows. There's a sudden flood. And muddy water flows over the whole field and destroys the crop. That's bad. But in so doing, the water carries silt. You know what silt is? Silt is the rich dirt from the riverbed. Very rich, fertile, productive dirt. Carries that silt from the riverbed onto your field, deposits it on your field, which means that in future years, your field is going to be much more productive. So that 3 years from now, if you calculate the loss of this year's crop, plus the next 3 years' increased productivity, you'll already be making a profit. And from there on out, you'll have a profit. So that's good. So this flood is both bad and good.
Isn't that
good? What's that?
It's good.
You lost your crop.
But the whole picture is good.
Well,
it's... There was some bad, but the end, the whole picture is good.
But that doesn't contradict there being bad in it, right? There's bad in it, there's good in it, both. You're making a bottom line judgment. Okay, maybe so. That's a third item. Doesn't cancel out the fact that there's bad in the picture.
What did you focus on?
You could have had a flood when there was no crop standing in the field, right? So now, what bracha do you make? The bracha on something bad happening or the bracha on something good happening? The answer is you make the bracha on something bad happening.
Because it happened first.
Because that's what's happening now. Nope, that's not the reason. That's not the reason.
You don't control. You don't know
if you're going to be lost tomorrow. That's not the reason. I want my heirs to have it. My heirs will have it. You know, that's not the reason. The reason is because that's what's happening now. The blessings on things that happen are blessings on things that happen now, not things that are going to happen. When you'll get there, maybe you'll make the blessing on something good. That isn't what happened now. Say that again? Some people get what?
Blessing that they don't have children. That happened. That's the future.
You don't make a blessing on Tovah Meitiv when someone gives you a wish that you should have children. You make the bracha when the child is born. We're talking now about making the blessing Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam HaTovah Meitiv. I'm not talking about going to someone and he wishes you or prays for you. We call that getting a blessing for someone. We're talking about making this blessing with these words. Okay? So the other Gemara says you make the blessing on something bad because there's something bad is what's happening now. And you only make the blessing on what's happening now. Even though, as several of you said, if I think about it intellectually, I know that on package it's good. On package, on whole it's good. As a package deal it's a good thing. Still, that's not what's happening now.
So you only make one blessing?
Yes, you only make one blessing. Whereas, if two things happen simultaneously, or one thing that has two effects simultaneously, then you do make both blessings simultaneously. You can make both blessings simultaneously. It's just that here, the good side isn't simultaneous. What's that?
Which one comes first in that case?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know.
But if the good came first, then you make the bracha on the good.
Yeah, whatever's happening now. Whatever's happening now.
You make the bracha a year later when you start to...
You might. And I don't know if it's dramatic enough. I mean, it happens suddenly enough. But in principle, yes. Now, what's the idea? The idea here is that you're making blessings on feeling. Here's the yisod. Here's the principle. The blessing is a blessing on the feeling. And feelings are tied to the present. Feelings are tied to the present. Feelings don't relate to the future in the same way, nor to the past in the same way. And the blessing is to express the feeling that you have. Let me explain what I mean. Here we are sitting at the end of January. Now, for most of you, when it comes to June, you're going to have a vacation period. Right? How excited are you now about summer vacation? I'll bet it doesn't occupy you more than once a week. But I'll bet in May, you're a lot more excited about summer vacation And I'll bet by June 10th, it's hard to think about anything else. And then summer vacation comes, and you're immersed in it. And then comes September. Wow, what a terrific summer. And you have the glow, and you talk about it. And by October, it's, yeah, summer, a great summer. And by November, it's out of sight already. And by December, you're already thinking about next year. You're not thinking about last summer anymore. Feelings are tied to the present.
Well, according to Judaism, you can't really look at feelings right now. You got to look at...
I'm talking about reality. The real person, the psychology of the real person is that feelings are tied to the present. That's the way people are made. The closer you are to the event, the more excited you are about it. Or, God forbid, if it's a bad event, the more fearful you are of it. The closer you get, the more fearful you are. Further away, you're not as fearful. Emotions are tied to the present. The mind is not tied that way. If I tell you, let's think about 100 years ago. Do you say, wait, 100 years? That takes me about 4 or 5 seconds to work it up. Well, let's think about 1,000 years ago. Oh, that takes me a whole minute. 1,000 years, that's quite a distance. Let me work, you know. Okay, 1850, 1750, 16. I'm working. You know, 1550, 1450, 1350. I'll get there. Just be patient, you know. 1250, 1150. Doesn't work like that. Oh, you mean 1003? Fine, I'm there. You want 03? Minus 103? You know, whatever you want. Time and space for the mind are no barriers at all. Think about the other side of the moon. It's 250,000 miles. Give me a chance. I'll just let me float out there. I'm floating. I'm going. Little by little, you know, is it okay? We reach the stratosphere. I'm coming. I'm moving. You know, in space it goes faster. It's all right. And I'll get there. He said, no. The mind isn't stuck like that. The mind can focus on anywhere and anywhen instantly without any trouble whatsoever. The emotions aren't like that. The emotions are pegged. If you tell me that, God forbid, that somebody's having a heart attack in the next room, even a stranger, that would be a shock. You tell me someone in Timbuktu is having a heart attack, and say, okay, I'm sure that there are people having heart attacks all over the world. That's the way it is. 6.5 billion people, you've got to expect that. The farther away it is, the less emotion it pulls out of me. Now, that means if I'll take the emotion on the one hand and look at the whole fact, the whole world on the other hand, very often the emotion and the world don't fit. They really don't fit. Because the world includes the future. And my emotion doesn't include the future. So you could say to the person, why are you upset about losing that wheat crop? Don't you know that 3 years from now you'll have a much bigger balance? The person could say, if he can articulate it, what he'll say is, you're right, I know, but I put 6 months of labor into that wheat, and it was beautiful, and I see it being destroyed, and it hurts. It hurts because that's what's in front of my eyes. I know intellectually that I'm going to get a plus out of this. It still hurts. I'll feel better 2 years from now, but 2 years from now is then. It's not now. The feelings are affected by what's in front of your eyes, what you're experiencing at the moment. Now, the Torah says, make a blessing on those feelings. Make a blessing on those feelings. Which means those feelings are not wrong. Those feelings are not wrong. We are built that way. To have feelings that respond to the present, even though they're out of touch with the future, out of touch with the big picture. And the Torah doesn't say, listen, fool, look at the big picture and squash your emotions. You know, scramble them, remake them to be relevant to the big picture. No, the Torah doesn't say that. The Torah says, those are the feelings that you have. They're the appropriate feelings for you to have, even though you know that they're out of touch with the big picture. That's what I meant when I said that we could have emotions which are not right for the world, and yet the Torah says it's appropriate to have them. This was a little surprising to me when I discovered it, but it is, I think, an important idea. When David HaMelech says, Hashem, why are you sleeping? Well, open your eyes and see what's happening here. He is giving expression to emotions which he knows are out of touch with the picture, with the reality. But the emotion is caused by what he sees. What he sees is death, destruction, and tragedy. That's what he sees. His mind tells him he's only seeing a fragment of the whole. Good, that's what his mind tells him. But that's not what he sees. And his feelings are stimulated by what he sees. And the words that he says in Tehillim are an expression of what he sees. And that's an appropriate thing. It's appropriate for your feelings to respond to what's in front of you, even if that's out of touch with the larger picture.
Would it be better to not have the emotion, to like be able to think out of the emotion, or make the emotion what you think it should be? Like make the emotion like happiness on the week, because you know that later it's going to be. So you can make the emotion, so you'll have the emotion.
No, it seems not. Otherwise, I don't think they would have made a blessing. If this emotion is really second class, if it's just a concession to human weakness, if tzaddikim wouldn't have that emotion, then I don't think we would make a blessing on it. Rav Tesler asks, Nochem Ish Gamzu, the one who said Gamzu Latova on all the tragedies that overtook him, what blessing did he make on these tragedies? And Rav Tesler said, he also made the blessing Tayin Ha'emes. He could not say, Hatova Meiti, that God is good and does good. He could not say that. Yeah, God.
What about Rav Tesler when he goes to Bais HaMikdash and he sees the boxes and he starts smiling? It seems to be exactly opposite.
This is a very common mistake. If you look carefully there, you'll see, and the Bashar actually says it. You're not learning Daf Yomi, are you?
No.
We just learned that. Just finished that on Shabbos. He tore his clothes with the rest of them. He did Kriya with the rest of them.
But he's laughing. I don't care about the actions.
I'll go back to what he said. No, and what happens when you have a love-hate relationship? The fact that you have love doesn't mean you don't have hate. And the fact
tearing is the action. We're speaking here about the emotion. The laughing is more than emotion. The tearing is the action. So I'm saying here that there's emotion should be in love with that.
Well, action
is
expression.
Maris, not necessarily. Not in a case like this at all.
Of course in a case like this.
I need to do Kriya when I go to the coast. So I do Kriya. Does that mean I'm all sad? No, I don't even understand why we're crying. But I do Kriya.
But you're not Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva did it as an act of avelus, and he knew that you're supposed to feel sad, and he did feel sad. He felt sad and happy at the same time. The whole point of his remark is that you can have two contradictory emotions at the same time. That's where we started, right?
I'm sure you're saying that he did Kriya.
Of course.
Does that mean that because he's Rabbi Akiva and he did Kriya, he was for sure sad?
Right? Of course, he quotes HaKolamas Abel al Yerushalayim Zoch Verobis Ben Yana. Anyone who mourns for Yerushalayim will have the merit of seeing it rebuilt. Right? But that means you have to mourn for it. He fulfilled that. He had to have the sadness and the happiness simultaneously. Of course.
How idea seems to go against everything.
No. Read it again. Why?
It's going against logic.
This whole idea that you should be what the soul feels about, it seems to be a big shock.
Well, okay. That's good. It is shocking. It was shocking to me when I discovered it.
The whole point of the whole world is to try to see things how they really are, and that you move your emotions towards that. And the most integrated person in the world doesn't feel exactly what is happening.
How do you get a whole picture?
How do you make a distinction between when you should feel this and when you shouldn't feel this?
Oh, good. That's exactly the next question. I said that 42 minutes ago. That's exactly the next question. If this isn't the cutoff, is it in touch with reality or isn't it in touch with reality? Then what will be the criteria to know when your emotions are right and when your emotions are wrong? And the answer is only when the tradition tells you in detail, under these circumstances you're supposed to feel this, and under those circumstances you're supposed to feel that. You have to go through it detail by detail. My Rebbe spent a lot of time talking and teaching us about when certain emotions are appropriate. And it's a whole Torah. There's a whole Torah of emotions. And some of the things are quite surprising. Quite surprising. And you know where you see it? You go to a chasana. I mean, a real, from chasana, if you can stand it. Right? Now, if you go to a real from chasana, and you watch the chasana before the chuppah, what is he doing? He's going through lists and lists of sick people people with tragedies, people with problems, and he's praying for them. Part of the time he's crying. And he's in intense prayer, concentration, supplication. It's the day of his chasen. But he's in a very special position. It's like Yom Kippur for him. He's pure. He's someone who has special divine favor. And the kala underneath their veil is doing exactly the same thing. And under the chuppah, you look at them, you would think it was a funeral, Rahman Shatzah. That's what they're doing with the emotions of the happiest days of their lives. And then, once the ceremony is finished, so then they rejoice. And you see a person who was looking as if he was in the lowest possible emotional depths, in the greatest emotional heights. It's awesome. It's awesome. Show me a chassid anywhere in the world, in any culture, that has that kind of depth, that has that kind of subtlety, that has that kind of power. But here it is. The person's in the happiest day of his life, and what does he do? He takes that happiness and uses it as a vehicle whereby he can help other people in terrible pain, and he shares their pain, and he feels their pain. The Rebbe talked to us many times about feeling pain at times of joy, and feeling joy at times of pain. The appropriateness of the mixture of emotions. But the answer to your question, his question is the logical question. If the criterion is not bring your emotions in line with the big picture, what then will the criterion be? And the answer is there is no the criterion. Each circumstance has to have its own description. And I can't resist. Zechu the Mikdash. We do things in remembrance of the Mikdash. Of the temple that's gone. So, and many people at a chasana put ashes on the chasana's head, and of course we have Tisha B'Av. Those are remembrances of the temple, which are painful. They're expressions of mourning. What about taking the lulav all 7 days of Sukkot? That was done only in the temple. When the temple was destroyed, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said we should do it everywhere. That's not mourning. That's not a veilus. That's an expression of simcha, of joy. At the Seder, we have the hill of sandwich, korech, because that's the way they used to do it in the Beis HaMikdash. That's not mourning for the temple on at the hill of Seder. That's an expression of simcha. So some things you do to remember the Beis HaMikdash create simcha now. And some things you do to remember the Beis HaMikdash create avelus now, create mourning now. It's not a simple picture. It's a mixed picture. There's a whole Torah, of how emotions have to be done.
You have to go over something every single time where emotions, that's crazy.
Yeah,
it's
a tough one.
There's a difference between the brain and emotions. One is done by consciousness, one's not. In a way, are you saying that emotions are physical?
Yes. The emotions are tied much more to the body than to the neshama. And last line, which probably can't be understood, but we are, as people, soul and body. The body is part of who you are. To rebel against the emotions, to try to force the emotions into the pattern of the soul only, is in a way to rebel against being embodied. And it is not appropriate to rebel against being embodied. The body has to be controlled. The body has to be focused. The body has to be elevated. But not to rebel against being embodied. And to try to force the emotions into the pattern of the soul would be to deny the body its appropriate expression. That, I think, is the underlying philosophical idea.